Welcome to the U.S. National Privacy and Cybersecurity Podcast. My name is Jason Shoup, and I am the executive director of today's sponsor, the Association of Data and Cyber Governance. The association offers a discount on memberships for our podcast listeners when they go to www.adcg.org and use the code word POD. Today, we are led by our host, Jody Westby. We hope you enjoy the episode and don't forget to leave us a rating or a comment.
This is Jody Westby, and this week I'm joined by Peter Halperin, a partner at Passage LLP's New York office. Peter represents commercial policyholders in complex insurance coverage matters involving cyber breaches and cybercrime, COVID-19, natural disasters, professional services, regulatory investigations and class actions, and technology disputes. So a broad range of complex insurance coverage matters, but with deep expertise in the cyber world. So Peter, welcome. It's such a pleasure to have you with us today. There's been so much emphasis this past year on ransomware and cyber claims and the increases in premiums. I know our listeners will love hearing your views regarding cyber insurance. So let's start by asking you to share with us your general thoughts on the state of the cyber insurance and cyber claims. What's happening out there? What are companies thinking?
Well, thank you, Jody, first of all, for having me. It is a pleasure to be on your podcast. And it's also just a pleasure to speak with you. I feel like every time we talk, I learn a lot, particularly about corporate governance and the intersection with cyber insurance and cybersecurity. So I appreciate the opportunity. It's a confusing time. That's how I describe it for companies, particularly in the C-suite. On one hand, there is a increased demand for cyber insurance. More and more clients are having it as a requirement in contractual agreements. People are concerned about privacy and data risks. Mm-hmm. And so it's on the mind of boards. Regulators are raising it. You're hearing it from both state regulators like the New York Department of Financial Services and at the federal level from the SEC, but also just an alphabet soup of organizations, Department of Energy, Department of Transportation, others are all getting involved in regulating this space. And so there's a lot of focus on it. But I say that it's a confusing time because at the same time, there's increased demand for the product. The underwriting community, I think, has not quite figured out how to price and maintain the product. And so there's a lot of pressure on clients to ostensibly pay more for less. So it's a very confusing time, particularly at the board level.
Yep. And those that did take the steps and did things right are getting penalized anyway. They're getting a premium increase along with everybody else.
Yeah. And you know, I was telling you this when we were preparing for this, but I had a funny conversation with, or not so funny, but conversation with the CISO in the healthcare space, who was telling me a story about how the board asked him to present on their cyber insurance program. And he explained to them that they had a 200% increase. And they said to him, well, what are we doing wrong? What's wrong with our security? What is it about what we do that caused our premiums to double? And he said, nothing. In short, nothing. We went through a long, complicated application process and we had the underwriters scrutinize our security practices. And they said we're best in class, but doesn't matter. That's the market. So it's a very confusing, very challenging time for companies.
Really? Absolutely. What about claims? 2021 was a huge year for cybercrime and ransomware. You usually get involved when carriers balk and don't want to pay claims. So what about the claims? Are carriers paying insurance claims or are they for cyber coverage or are they becoming more disputatious?
I love that word, disputatious. I'm going to try to use it as much as I can, probably with my 4-year-olds. I think that, it's interesting is because there's no standardization in this space in terms of there is no ISO form, standard form product that everyone's using, meaning that the wording differs. There is a lot of uncertainty when it comes to claims and how claims are managed and what's covered versus what's not covered. There's just no standard. So just because one policy covers something doesn't necessarily mean that another policy covers something. And just because one policy excludes something doesn't necessarily mean that another policy excludes the same thing. So it's kind of a crapshoot. It's kind of the wild, wild west out there. So the short answer is, yes, we're definitely seeing disputed claims. I'm particularly seeing disputed claims arising out of ransomware attacks, and most often in the area of business interruption losses. So what happens is you have a ransomware attack. It results in a period of downtime for the business in dealing with the effects of the attack. And so they lose, you know, sales opportunities, they lose income. And once they lose income, now there's a question, and we often see the accountants involved, where the policyholder, you know, explains that their business was down and they've lost millions of dollars of revenue. And the insurance company will come back and say, well, no, you know, our accountants took a look at everything and we disagree. We think the number's far lower. So I'm seeing a lot of disputes in that regard. But I think the dispute that's causing the most consternation in this space, particularly for policyholders, is there was a recent lawsuit where Travelers sued one of their policyholders after a ransomware attack and said that the policyholder had failed to adequately disclose their multi-factor authentication setup in the insurance application. So policyholder filled out a lengthy insurance application to get the insurance, made claims about what they had in terms of multi-factor authentication. And when it came time to pay the claim, Travelers said, oh, no, wait a minute. Your multi-factor authentication wasn't what you said it was, and therefore we are entitled to void the policy and we don't have to pay the claim. So that's a litigation that's currently that just started. And so a lot of people are looking to that because I think, Jody, we talked about this briefly, but the applications have become so cumbersome, so long. You know, they can be 30 or 40 pages with multiple addenda that it's such a struggle to fill them out that companies are really concerned. And now, given this lawsuit, they've got to look back at their applications and, you know, dot their T's and cross their I's, right, to make sure that they got everything right.
Dot their T's and cross their I's, yeah. That's about how those applications go. And it brings us full circle back to the premium increase, because to me, the insurance industry has itself to blame for this. Their underwriting has always been stupid for cyber. They just wanted market share. So they got market share and then they started expanding the applications. So they just kept expanding the applications to think they would kind of keep up with the threat environment, but they never really figured out how to underwrite cyber. And so now that's why the companies that were doing well are still getting a hike and an increase in their premium. But I think it's also why these forms are so convoluted. And now companies like Travelers may look to those forms and say, well, you didn't really answer this. It was a misrepresentation. So to me, it's the application and the underwriting process that is just totally at the crux of the problem. Do you see that process changing?
Yes. I think it's going to become more cumbersome. I've heard stories where clients are saying that the insurers actually want the clients to do tabletop exercises that the insurers can observe so that they can see, you know, really how things work in practice. But it is getting to kind of an absurd place, because once you get there, you know, what's left is that the insurers are underwriting the safest risks and not touching the more dangerous ones. And as we know, you know, the best way for a pool to function is to capture both those risky risks as well as those good risks to balance them out.
I have never heard anything so ridiculous. Really? They want to observe a tabletop and they think that's going to help them determine whether it's a good risk? Oh my word. That is very interesting. One thing you mentioned when we were chatting was the ambiguity in these applications and some of the risks associated with that. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, you have a 30-page application with, you know, all these addenda and all these questions that are being asked. And many of them are in simple kind of yes or no form. So, you know, saying to someone, do you have adequate cybersecurity? Yes or no. It was a pretty difficult way to go about things. I mean, I'm a lawyer, so my favorite answer is it depends, right? I don't even know how to answer yes or no to things. So, you know, it's very, very difficult for companies to try to answer these questions. And I think for a lot of them, you know, they want the product so badly and they are doing their best to answer the questions. But again, it doesn't always lend itself to a simple yes or no. So the advice that we give our clients, and by the way, that I followed myself when we did our own insurance application, you know, is to put in your own addenda, you know, put in your own written explanation for something that requires more than a simple yes or no, or ask questions. You know, you can always pose questions back to the carrier or back to your broker, you know, to send to the carrier that say, well, we don't really understand what this means. And I'll give you a simple example. As part of the application that we received, there was a reference to the, you know, national data privacy laws. Well, you know, Jody, you know better than I do, but here in the United States, it's hard to put anything together at the national level, right? Most of these programs and statutory regimes originate at the state level. So, you know, if you're trying to answer something about the American Privacy Act, that doesn't exist. There's no way to comply or not comply. So I think given that, you know, you really sometimes want to question the questioner and make sure that the questions are clear, that they're understandable, and that you can answer them, and that you can answer them sufficiently. And if you need more information, get more information.
Well, have you ever been asked by a client to review their application before they turned it in to the insurance company?
I haven't, only for our own company. I do get asked about insurance policy wording, but frankly, at that point, it's too late because they've already filled out the application, they've already gone through the process, you know, and now they're just asking us to kind of Monday morning quarterback what they received. So if you do want to get lawyers involved in that process, you want to do it early on. You want to do it while you're filling out the application if you need that assistance. And then when you're talking about wording, you want to try to get that well in advance of any placement or any renewal, so that if you do want to make changes, you have time to do that.
What did you tell me? There are like 500 companies selling cyber insurance. Is that what you said?
I believe that statistic somewhere around 2020 was about 520 or 530. So there were 520 or 530 companies independently that were providing cyber insurance in this market. I suspect that many have left, but there are also many new entrants. So it's possible that that number is still the case.
Well, how can the insurance industry be this screwed up? I mean, why can't they get a standard application? Even universities and college applications have figured this out. Why can't they get a standard application? Is it because they don't even know what they're doing, or they don't want to, or they think that's giving away the keys to the kingdom? Or do you have any idea?
It's a great question. I think some of it is still that it's a fairly nascent market and everyone's trying to develop new products and be leaders in this space. So I think it's just they're still at a competitive point. But there are some changes here. We are starting to see some collaboration, particularly in the realm of claims, from some of the largest carriers. And I do think that there's an increasing desire to move toward some form of standard form. So I think in terms of, you know, being positive about the outlook for the future, you know, it may be that as the product matures, we get to more standardized language and also more sharing of data on the claim side to help standardize also the application process.
Well, I hope so. We're only 20 years into this. You would think that by now we could get that done. Let's look at another aspect of this when we talk about complex insurance coverage matters. With the planet in conflict in seemingly every corner, especially Russia, Ukraine, and front and center, what about the war exclusion? That got invoked by a couple of carriers after big claims from NotPetya cyber attacks in 2017. When those claims started rolling in, Zurich invoked the war exclusion against Mondelez on a $100 million claim. But now Ace America has lost against Merck's $1.4 billion claim under its all-risk policies. Is the war exclusion a big concern companies should be aware of?
So you ask a great question. I think one of the number one issues in the cyber insurance market is the war exclusion. And what does that look like in a cyber policy? We mentioned the lack of a standard form. We mentioned the number of market entrants. And so what I often see, I'll have clients say, we want you to do a policy review. Can you take a look at the wording of my cyber policy? And I'll take a look. And, you know, again, with no standardization, I've seen tremendous variety in war exclusions. And just for your listeners who may not know, you know, the typical exclusion will exclude essentially kinetic war or a shooting war from coverage, which is fairly typical going back to property insurance. And then in the cyber realm, we'll also include some kind of carve back for quote unquote cyber terrorism. But again, you have to look at the words and the definition of cyber terrorism, which varies widely from policy to policy. So that's what the war exclusion is. But in terms of whether or not it's an issue, you know, this came up, as you mentioned, in the Mondelez case and the Merck case. And in those cases, the policies at issue were not pure cyber policies. So one of the things that you hear from the industry is, don't worry about those cases. Those aren't cyber policies. And while I still think that it is a worry and something that people need to think about, particularly when they're reviewing their policies, I do think that there are some important nuances. So, for example, in a typical standalone cyber insurance policy, there is reference, as I mentioned, to this concept of cyber terrorism. In the more or less property form that was litigated in Merck, there was no discussion of anything in the cyber realm in the war exclusion there. So I do think that there are some important differences there. But I do think the Merck case is also notable for a number of reasons. Most importantly, court looked to the history of war exclusions. And it goes back, I believe, probably around, I think, the Korean War or some of the more recent quote-unquote cases. That's kind of how the history. So there aren't a tremendous number of cases on point. But when the court looked at the history, the court said, well, you know, this really is about a shooting war. And if the insurer in Merck wanted to capture, you know, malware or anything of that nature, they could have done so by amending their language over the last, you know, 10 or so years, but they failed to do so. And so that has to be held against the insurance company. And so I do think that courts looking at cyber insurance policies with their war exclusions will have different considerations and different wording to take a look at. But it does raise this kind of cautionary tale of what happens given, as you mentioned, you know, conflict in every corner.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was a little silly when the companies first invoked this, because the United States government publicly blamed Russia for these attacks doesn't mean it was an act of war or that it was, you know, something that would trigger a war exclusion clause. But nevertheless, they didn't ask me. They went off and did this. And what intrigued me was Merck, in this $1.4 billion claim under its all-risk policies. Now, the last time I had looked, I thought Merck's losses were up to $700 million plus. But I had no idea we were looking at a $1.4 billion claim. And then when I noted this was the fight was under its all-risk policies, it made me wonder, well, then why buy cyber insurance? But maybe that's more for business interruption that they.
No, it's a great question. I mean, what's interesting about the Merck case is I believe in their public filings, they said that they had over 40,000 damaged pieces of equipment.
Yeah, they did.
So, I mean, you can see, let's say that there was no cyber attack, right? And this was a hurricane claim or, you know, any kind of more typical property claim where 40,000 pieces of equipment around the world were destroyed. I mean, you could, for a multinational company like that, you can see them getting over $1 billion in damages pretty quickly, right? I mean, so that makes sense. But I do think that that's also why the business interruption component of a cyber policy can be so important, right? Because in most instances, and I gave you those examples earlier of claims that I'm seeing where clients are fighting over business income losses, you know, the actual disruption itself, the property damage, the lost equipment, usually is just a fraction of the impact that's caused the company. The biggest driver of their loss generally is that downtime, is that inability to generate a profit for long periods of time.
Yeah, the business interruption loss is the big deal. So with the steep increases in these cyber premiums, how are companies managing? Are they reducing coverage or moving to captives to cover cyber losses? What are they thinking about? What are they doing?
Great question. It is all over the place. I have some clients who are just considering dropping cyber coverage entirely. They're large enough and they've decided that they're being asked to pay so much in premiums or so much in coinsurance that it's just not worth it to them and that they'd rather just self-insure. I'm also seeing, you mentioned captives, some clients moving into the captive realm. So they're looking to put together a cyber insurer to manage their claims. That's easier when they have captives on other lines. That's where I'm seeing it more often, is that they're already in the captive space. So it's just adding a line of coverage. Mm-hmm. Some clients are just taking on huge retentions. So they're essentially self-insuring to some degree. Others are looking to move into the reinsurance realm and to have kind of pass-throughs, which is, you know, like a captive structure, but essentially moving into the secondary or reinsurance markets and all kinds of other combinations. I mean, some clients, you know, as I mentioned earlier, they're being forced to obtain cyber insurance to comply with contractual requirements. So, you know, they're looking to offload risks in their contracts and they're trying to reduce the burden there and to manage risk there. So all of the above. And, you know, I think that, again, as the market matures, hopefully we'll see a leveling out in terms of premiums and we'll see more standardization, which will make it easier for everyone to wrap their arms around the risks.
Well, I hope so. It concerns me when companies start reducing coverage. And you're right, the captives, that's more for the big companies as an option. But with the steep increases in cyber premiums, I want to ask about D&O coverage, because cyber event-driven litigation in the form of shareholder, derivative, or securities class action lawsuits are now commonplace. And my guess is many boards are unprepared for that. One of these cases, either a shareholder derivative or securities class action, could easily use up the entire legal limit on a D&O policy. What are your thoughts on this? Are boards and C-suites adequately prepared for the D&O risks that flow from cyber events?
Yeah, that is a fantastic point. And I said to you at the outset of this, you know, one of the things I enjoy about talking to you is that you're always on the pulse of kind of what's happening with boards. So I think what this highlights is the spillover risk of cyber, right? It touches in so many areas. You're absolutely right that you know, defense costs can be swallowed pretty quickly. In some of these massive litigations, we're seeing, you know, eye-popping settlements in some other instances. So, you know, you absolutely need to think about your D&O limits in the context of these kinds of litigations. But I also think another area that the company should be thinking about, both D&O and often E&O risks, is in terms of regulatory risk. You have regulators from an alphabet soup of government agencies now going after companies following the disclosure of, you know, various incidents, looking for, you know, looking for blood. I mean, they're looking for, you know, big dollar figure resolutions to resolve what they see as kind of a public wrong. So we saw with a company called First American Title. They were a title insurance company who was accused of having known vulnerabilities that they failed to address. And these known vulnerabilities, because they involved, you know, people's personal information in real estate transactions, can't remember the exact number, but I think it was like tens of millions of records involving personal information. So first, the New York Department of Financial Services went after them. Then there was a class action lawsuit against the company, basically parroting what the Department of Financial Services had raised in its complaint. And then, because it was a public company, the SEC went after them and said that they had made inadequate financial disclosures about the incident. And so you had this just kind of piling on. Recently, I read about the FTC going after Twitter, the Department of Energy going after Colonial Pipeline. And then there was a third one involving the Department of Transportation. Maybe it was also Colonial Pipeline. And so you're just seeing all these regulators going after all these companies. And I think it's an underappreciated part of cyber risk, which is what will the regulators do? And I've had conversations with brokers who have done complex models for my clients to show them their risks. And I've said, well, what about the regulatory risk? And again, they say, oh, well, you know, it's too new. It's hard for us to map. It's hard for us to take into account. But the figures that we're seeing are eye-popping. And so I do think at the C-suite level, there needs to be a discussion of, are we adequately protected against regulatory risk arising from cyber?
Big time. Because even though those lawsuits are not getting in very far in the courts, they're going on to appeal, and then they're settling on appeal. And because it's cheaper to settle than to fight the litigation. So that will keep them coming. But with the regulators, this is a very important thing you bring up, and especially the case with known vulnerabilities. I mean, companies have to realize, as Facebook is facing now, that former employees can turn into whistleblowers. And there are plenty of people and companies that understand security vulnerabilities in a system. And usually it's pretty well known when the CISO doesn't have money to upgrade servers, to upgrade equipment, or people are operating on older versions of Windows, or they just feel like that their IT systems are sort of held together with scotch tape and pins. But I think we're going to see more and more, and you're talking about regulators, I think we're going to see more and more in the form of former employees turn into whistleblowers, or that when an event happens, former employees come forward and say, yes, this has been happening. Yes, this occurred, or yes, they had an incident and didn't tell anybody. So the regulators are certainly there, but I think there's a lot of risk even within their own organization that companies aren't paying attention to. And we can't forget the EU. I mean, the EU is just as hot on this, if not more so, than U.S. regulators. So I think between the SEC beating the cyber drum and the EU on and with all of its initiatives, that the regulatory point is a very, very important one. That you're right, companies don't really have their arms around it because a lot of this isn't written yet. But they have to have the ability to at least look into the future, to see the horizon and to know where they're headed.
And Jody, I'm not an expert in privacy law. I'm a humble country insurance lawyer from New York City. But I was on a panel recently where someone who was an expert in the space was also highlighting China and just saying that part of this kind of great power competition also involves a regulatory competition where Chinese regulators are also looking at some of these issues. So you're absolutely right to highlight the global challenge, and it may be even bigger than just what's immediately before us.
Well, I want to go back to say that we're about out of time, but I want to ask you, how do companies get their arms around this and prepare? I mean, we've laid out such a messy plate here of, the insurance market and their underwriting process, the applications are a mess, the premiums are going sky high. We've got war exclusions people are banding about, D&O, legal limits, and regulators running off the reservation. I mean, how do companies prepare for that? Are any of them coming to you up front and saying, what can we do?
Very carefully. So I think it is, first of all, insurance is important, but insurance is a backstop. It is a last resort. It's when things go wrong. So the best advice that I can give to companies is to really invest in cyber hygiene, in network security, in all of the things that you can do to defend yourself against these threats. I think that's number one. I think number two, the lesson from the regulators is the ostrich approach does not work. So companies that are getting hit hard by regulators are getting hit hard for known vulnerabilities. And in particular, if you read the complaint for First American, you can see that the issue was brought to the attention of high-level people at the board and in their CISO suite numerous times, and no one did anything. So that it's an egregious case, but it highlights kind of what not to do. And then lastly is to have that insurance backstop in place so that you know that if all of these things fail, you have that kind of bottom line protection. But I really would stress that the insurance dollars and expenditure should be a lower priority than the defense measures.
Well, I would add one thing to your list, which is companies should get their arms around this and prepare by having a good insurance attorney on their retainer list, because when the insurance company denies your claim, you want to be ready. This has been such a great conversation. Do you have a final parting thought you'd like to leave with our listeners?
I think it's just to take these things very seriously. I mean, if they're your listeners, then they probably already are. I think it's just trying to stay informed and stay abreast of these developments, and to take a conservative approach where you try to protect your company as best you can, and then make sure that if things fail, you have the insurance you need.
Because this environment is going to continue to be disputatious, right?
I cannot wait to share this with my four-year-olds.
Thank you so much, Peter. It's just been a pleasure. We'll have to cycle back on this in about 6 months and see where we stand.
My pleasure. Thank you again, Jody. Appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us this week on the U.S. National Privacy and Cybersecurity Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed today's podcast and want more content about the issues we've covered, you can visit www.adcg.org. The Association for Data and Cyber Governance is the leading association connecting all aspects of data management, cybersecurity, and governance. Our listeners can use the code POD at checkout for a discount on all memberships. Thank you for listening, and we hope you will join us next week.